and conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at the state of our so-called free press, media mendacity, and manufacturing consent in the Trump era. We're joined by journalist Abby Martin of the Empire Files, which airs on Telesur. Whistleblowing journalist and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson joins the conversation. And Project Censored senior correspondent Michael Levitin speaks to Justin Schlossberg. He's the chair of the Media Reform Coalition at the University of London. An hour analyzing media on the Project Censored Show. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the state of our so-called free press. We'll be discussing media mendacity, so-called fake news, and manufacturing consent in the Trump era. Our first guest today, returning to the program, is journalist Abby Martin of the Empire Files, which airs on Telesur. Abby Martin, of course, is a founder of Media Roots and had a program on Russia Today called Breaking the Set. And Abby Martin, of course, goes back with us a ways at Project Censored on the board at Media Freedom Foundation. Abby, thanks for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mickey and Peter.
So, Abby, not long ago, you were back in the corporate news media, and this time it was the New York Times. Can you sort of recap for us that latest fracas with the New York Times propaganda and misinformation?
Sure. Well, as we know, leading up to Donald Trump's inauguration, there was a concerted effort on behalf of the establishment, both the political establishment, neoconservatives, neoliberals, as well as the entire media apparatus, trying to push this Russia hacked the election story. So much to the point where 52% of registered Democrats actually believed that Russia actually altered the vote. So this was a huge concerted effort. I feel like a lot of deep state activity to try to delegitimize Trump. I absolutely hate Trump. I think he's terribly frightening, and we can go into that later. But this was a very clear effort to try to do that. The DNI intelligence report that came out that was long awaited, waiting for this so-called evidence of Russian interference in our election, was really just a thrown together hodgepodge document that looked like it was done in an hour by some Heritage Foundation intern. Basically, it was just half bashing RT programming, Russia Today programming.
By the way, you haven't been on Russia Today for how long?
2 years.
Right. So I guess they're catching up to you.
Exactly. So this is a claim by the intelligence community on behalf of these 17 agencies that Russia Today, specifically my show, was this kind of propaganda vector when the Kremlin decided to interfere in our elections and start to foment this radical discontent. They called my show Fomenting Radical Discontent, which is a very Orwellian, neo-McCarthyist term that is very scary. Fast forward to the New York Times, that not only published an article that day saying this report is damning, serious allegations here, total slam dunk, right? You have Rachel Maddow, all these other people in the establishment press saying it was amazing, slam dunk. But the next day after defended the intelligence report, they actually had the audacity, Russ Goldman was the author, to write a piece using me and Liz Wall as these prime examples of Russia Today anchors that quit in protest,
right,
and denounced the station as Russian propaganda. And this article was up for an entire day. I don't know how many people read the New York Times. Thank God it wasn't printed in their actual edition in New York, but it was up on the website for a day after many people told him it was full of egregious lies. And in fact, when I finally forced him to correct it, he did. But when he corrected it, it still pushed forward a narrative that was false. It still said, oh, I quit sometime after I denounced Putin propaganda on air. That's completely erroneous. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were misconstruing the truth because they knew that the truth actually undermined their entire narrative, which is that I was able to denounce RT's programming and Putin and still keep the primetime show on the network for a year and still speak out against Russia and still speak out whenever I wanted to. So really, what does that say? It says that I was able to push my editorial freedom far beyond, I'm sure, people at the New York Times ever will.
Or CNN, for that matter.
It seems like intelligence agencies are still living in the communist era, the Cold War era, and bringing some of that theme back in that the Russians are hacking U.S. Democrats and up to mischief, and that you're a agent of provocation or fermenting their ideas. And once you do that, once you're a commie, you're always a commie, I think, is the history of that. even though you haven't been there in 2 years and you're doing other stuff. Tell
and
us
Putin's not a commie.
Exactly. But there's still that belief and system there. So were you charged with fake news?
I'm kind of thrown in the crosshairs here because, of course, the Democrats have now riled up this like anti-communist fervor, you know, like a lot of liberals are now hating on communists. They're using this iconography of the hammer and sickle. It's very confused. There cannot be a legitimate resistance against Trump if people are confused and conflating communism with capitalism. And in fact, not even capitalism. It's this oligarchic ruling class that is basically the same, whether you're looking at the U.S. or Russia. So, yes, of course, I was called fake news. I'm called fake news by, you know, this term has been weaponized now. We handed it basically to Trump, where now he can just call anything that disagrees with his alternative facts fake news. And good job, corporate media, for now trying to weaponize this term. Delegitimizing all non-corporate media. That's what they were doing. Publish a list that literally was just alternative media, non-corporate funded as fake news.
And Abby Martin, that went back to Proper Not, right? And that was run by a former national security editor, Craig Timberg, over at the Washington Post, who didn't vet it, didn't research it at all, just ran that list. And, of course, many independent journalists were on that list, many of them, of course, whom we know. And, again, some of them threatened to sue for slander or libel. They had a very tepid retraction on that. Of course, they were later caught, the Washington Post, in their own fake news tornado when they talked about the Russians hacking the power grid in Vermont. Right. All the while peddling
Absolutely.
Fake news. And let's trace fake news back a little bit in terms of its most recent incarnation or iteration coming out of the DNC as a red herring to blame this issue, fake news, to call attention away from the horrible campaign that the Democrats ran.
Yeah, absolutely. There was someone that just did a study on the whole fake news hysteria and found out, guess what? Fake news had virtually no impact on the election.
And the term fake news, like you said, it's also now weaponized, and thanks to the use of it in corporate media, specifically from the liberal angle, right, neoliberal angle, that the Democrats are trying to distract away from their candidate, from their problems, from the chicanery in their own primary regarding Bernie Sanders and the corruption at the DNC and the so-called leadership there. Now the term fake news, like you said, they midwifed it right into corporate media and right over to Donald Trump. And now it's weaponized and can be used in any direction.
And he's already shown such utter contempt for the press. I am the least bit of an apologist or for corporate news networks, as you know, Mickey and Peter. But wow, when I see a sitting president treating the press corps with this much contempt, that's a scary, scary trend.
That certainly is an amazing piece of what's been happening. I mean, the New York Times actually has said Trump lied, but NPR won't say he lied. They're simply saying that, well, he probably didn't understand, maybe didn't really know it wasn't a truth or something along that line, kind of apologetic. Do you think the New York Times is taking a lead in challenging Trump?
No, they've really lost their legitimacy, unfortunately, because when you just shill 100% for one corporate candidate over the other, it does make people trust you less. So I don't think the New York Times is really the people that are going to be marching forward on this path to resist Trump. I think it needs to still come from the alternative media. And I think that people across the board need to stop misunderstanding that Breitbart and InfoWars are somehow truthful alternative press. It seems like there's a big conflation now on behalf of the establishment to try to demonize alternative media as fake news. Now we have this tug and pull amongst alternative news networks that are legitimate, let's say Truthdig, Project Censored, Counterpunch, now battling with actual fake news. When I say fake news, I mean Breitbart, InfoWars, people who pull up these hysterical fear-mongering narratives about Islam, immigrants, refugees, and women, and use it to bait people in order to bolster their agenda and narrative. I think that we all need to be calling Trump the pathological liar that he is, instead of obsessing endlessly down this rabbit hole of every single time that he releases a false statement or knowingly lie. We need to simply say he's a pathological liar, correct it, of course, but not endlessly debate this, because he is a master manipulator and he knows how to hijack the media. This is what he's been doing this whole time. That's why he's president. So we need to stop reacting and be in front of the curve here.
Abby Martin, speaking of being in front of that curve, again, this is handed basically right over to Trump. And Steve Bannon, who is all over in the White House from Breitbart.com, former CEO there, knows very well how to hijack narratives, knows very well how to distract and bait and switch, knows very well how to throw the red meat to the lions, so to speak. And, you know, when Trump first came in and went to the CIA, of all places, He used it as a platform with his fake crowd, right, clapping for him, mm-hmm. to attack and denigrate the media. He'd use his bizarre announcement for Black History Month to attack the media. I mean, so this is definitely a tactic that we see coming out. And he specifically has been singling out CNN. And I read a Reuters piece about reacting to this. And I'm just curious to hear, what do you think, as a journalist, should be the kind of reaction to this treatment and this hostility?
It's getting really rabid. A lot of people are conflating now free speech to basically neo-Nazis and all of these alt-right people. Look, I personally don't think that we should be using federal-funded public institutions to give platforms to hateful fearmongers like these. I mean, of course, I'm not advocating shutting down. They're free to do whatever they want. They're free to go speak. I'm just saying the rhetoric now is so heightened and divisive, and that's exactly what people like Steve Bannon and Trump want. I think that liberals and leftists need to unite. I think that instead of blaming leftists for the loss, the abysmal loss and crushing of the Clinton dynasty, they need to be reaching out and understanding why they need this base in order to create a united front against Trump. I think the responsibility of journalists and editors is to not only react, of course, to these Trump statements and to dissect the rhetoric and say what's true and false, but I think it's a huge loss when you're not using your analysis to give a deeper context to why these things are happening. Islamophobia didn't just happen in a vacuum. This has been fostered and cultivated for the last 15 years. The systems have been in place. We have a police state apparatus, a surveillance state apparatus. We have all been talking about this for the last 15 years. We never carried water for any sitting president. We understood precisely the dangers of creating something like the National Defense Authorization Act, the eradication of habeas corpus. We understood that once a demagogic crazy person like Trump, who would be in power of these things, that's how dangerous and quickly things can unfold. So I think that the media is really doing a disservice when they don't explain how these things happened and why. And also, they're complicit because they allowed Obama to perpetuate this entire system. And when you don't prosecute war criminals and when you don't stop bombing seven Muslim countries, well, then you're going to get Trump and you're going to get the Muslim ban because Islamophobia has been rooted in this country for the last 15 years.
Abby, you interviewed Noam Chomsky in December. This was before the inauguration. And he's quoting Norman Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute as saying the Republican Party is a radical insurgency, which has abandoned the parliamentary politics, and they're just ready to go bomb people. Do you think that he was accurate in describing it that way?
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people, like Chris Hedges is really into explaining how the Christian right has used all these institutions over the last 30 years. And we see that, you know, the fruition of people like Mike Pence and Betsy DeVos. And now Eric Prince is now advising Trump behind the scenes. Very scary Christian evangelical figures. However, the alt-right, I think, is a new movement that isn't even necessarily Christian. Yet they embody all this kind of fascistic rhetoric and really hateful tendencies. And I think that there's two forces that we need to be worried about. I think the Republicans were on their way out until Trump was able to capture that kind of populist rhetoric. And Steve Bannon, I really think, is the Karl Rove behind Trump's brain. And I think that when you look at Steve Bannon's rhetoric and what he's been doing the last 10 years, he has been fostering that kind of Alex Jonesy audience where he's saying we need to overthrow the Republican establishment. We need to abolish the Republican establishment. They hated those traditional Republicans. They said that they were weak. It's been an ethno-white nationalist push, very ideologically driven. And so you have two fronts now where you see kind of the old Republican guard leeching on the power. All those never Trumpers, where the hell are they? They seem to be falling in line quicker than anyone else, you know, other than the Democrats, of course. So I do think there are two forces we need to be fighting equally, but also understanding how they're different and similar.
Including Senator Tim Kaine, who has greenlighted all of these Trump nominations. That's not getting a lot of attention. You know, you mentioned something here, Abby Martin. Those of you just tuning in, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. We're speaking with journalist Abby Martin. Her recent show is called The Empire Files on Telesur. Abby Martin, you know, the term alt-right is being thrown around a lot, and we use it because it's sort of a zeitgeist. But is alt-right also some kind of dog whistling for what you also said? You said white nationalist, and we are also seeing terms like neo-fascist.
Yes, I think that really when you look at the alt-right, you know how I said before, it's not necessarily that they're even Christian. They don't have a political ideology. The alt-right is basically a reactionary force off of PC culture and what they call globalism, right? We've heard these dog whistling terms for a while. I think a lot of people who are in the conspiratorial framework heard these terms back in the day and thought maybe the New World Order, the elite, but now it's become a term that's actually vehemently like racist, anti-immigrant, nationalist. And you've seen people like Steve Bannon really take that globalism term and run with it. And I think that the alt-right really arose out of internet message boards. People have been emboldened that are essentially trolls. We have essentially an online troll in the White House. Trump is probably an atheist, for goodness sake, but he has cultivated and captured this base of people who now are proud and emboldened from their own bigotry. And it really came out of the throes of like university culture, this PC, you know, safe spaces. That's what these people are obsessed with. They think their biggest enemy is leftists and social justice warriors, they call them. And that to me is an extreme distortion on who the actual enemy is, the ruling class, the oligarchy, and the U.S. empire that carries out endless militarism around the world. And if we are distracted and baited by this group of vitriolic, hateful people who want to attack leftists, they're just doing the bidding of the empire now. I mean, how does that feel, guys? You're carrying water for a sitting president and now making leftists the enemy instead of militarism and empire. But I honestly don't think these people actually have a political ideology. They're just a reactionary force that's been given an extreme amount of power, and we see them all over the streets now taking that power to the streets.
We're speaking with journalist Abby Martin from the Empire Files, airs on Pellissure. So, Abby Martin, tell us a little bit more about Steve Bannon.
Steve Bannon is a guy, he was a Navy officer, he was a Goldman Sachs banker. He hitched his wagon to Drudge and Andrew Breitbart. He was kind of their protege. And of course, when Breitbart died at a young age, Steve Bannon really took the helm of that website. He's called it the hub of the alt-right. He's given a voice, really, to these white nationalists and really created that haven for them to thrive and grow. Steve Bannon really, like I said, he hitched his wagon to the right people. Trump has basically rewarded the people who worship him. So, you know, he's given power to all these GOP outliers who are considered too crazy even to be taken seriously by the mainstream Republican establishment. And Steve Bannon not only is a serial wife beater and child abuser, which really says a lot about his capabilities of actually like killing someone who's capable of strangling and choking their wife. Studies show that they're capable of murdering them as well. So that aside, he has for the last 10 years been pulling forward this Muslim ban idea, pushing forward the idea of no immigrants. He even said that the biggest problem with America is the fact that there are 20% immigrants here. And then he has the audacity to try to sue people who call him a white nationalist. So this is the thing, right? Deny, 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 yet put these ideas out, toxifying as they are, and yet deny that you are a neo-Nazi and white nationalist. It's time to call people what they are. But I think Steve Bannon is an incredibly dangerous character. You see all the executive orders that Trump is pushing through his first week. They're written in the language of Breitbart. The fact that Trump is saying he's going to publish crimes of immigrants. What does that sound like to you? It sounds like the homepage of Breitbart.com. So these are things that you see. Steve Bannon has been given unprecedented power. He not only is the chief strategist, he's now replaced the DNI head on the Security Council.
The Director of National Intelligence. Peter.
That's completely amazing when I read that and how the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're not invited every time. And the director of the CIA, I mean, it's like Steve Bannon has taken over national security for the United States of America, and they get to set out whatever agenda they have, which includes threatening the president of Mexico that they'll have to send troops down there if they can't take care of their bad guys. And we've already had an attack in Yemen where an 8-year-old girl was killed. So it's just an amazing thing, and now they're threatening Iran. It's terrifying.
Right out the gates, the first 2 weeks, you have Michael Flynn, psychotic Michael Flynn, who's salivating at the thought of war with Iran. Already, the Muslim ban, and by the way, it is a ban, and I'm free to talk about that as well. But all these people are like, oh, it's not a ban. Look, they've already entertained these ideas for years. Giuliani, the criminal of 9/11, even said on TV that Trump came to him, similarly that Bush did to John Yoo, and said, I want a Muslim ban. How do I make that legal? That's a fact. But Michael Flynn, right out the gates, you have Iran on the list, which is obviously direct confrontation with Iran. And then Michael Flynn coming out and saying, you're putting Iran on notice, like they're a 12-year-old child, putting them in the corner of the room. It is unbelievable what we're seeing within the first 2 weeks of Trump's presidency. And really, when you compare it to Obama's presidency, wow, how inept was that man? You could have come in there and done these sweeping measures with full control over Congress, and you just chose to sit on your hands. Great job, Obama. Well, guess what? These institutions are so fragile that they're being unraveled within days. Unbelievable.
Well, Abby Martin, talk a little bit more. You hinted at this, so talk a little bit more about the travel ban from these seven countries.
Right off the bat, none of the countries are any countries that have ever sponsored terrorism on American soil, that have killed any Americans. You're more likely to be killed by your clothes hanging in your closet than you are from a refugee. It's complete dog whistling, fear-mongering that has zero grounds in reality whatsoever. Trump, of course, whenever he does these sweeping broad measures that are extremely xenophobic, he always points to Obama, right? And a lot of times he's right when it comes to immigration. He's like, well, Obama deported more people than anyone else. True. But when it comes to the Muslim ban, Obama never outright banned a country. He named these seven countries as danger zones, dangerous to travel. I'm sure there was vetting involved. And he did do a six-month quote-unquote extreme vetting process where he vetted visas from Iraqi refugees. This, on the other hand, is a outright across-the-board ban from seven countries affecting 130 million people. And at the very beginning, Steve Bannon overrode the DHS and everyone else in the government to include green card holders. The only reason that they're excluded now is because three federal judges actually deemed it completely unconstitutional and illegal. So this is the reality that we're dealing with now, is people were denied medical attention. People died. There was one woman who died trying to see her family. A child is badly burned, probably will die because he can't get medical attention. A woman was deported who was a professor. It is very disturbing, and it was rolled out with such haste and no thought whatsoever that people were simply on planes having no idea what their status was and were sent back to their countries. And what my theory is that Steve Bannon was trying to push the limits of how far he could go. And that's a really scary thought.
Well, Abby Martin, it reminds me of a quote. It was attributed eventually to Karl Rove in the Bush White House, W. Bush White House, a book by Ron Suskind. There's a passage of it here. It says, the aide said that guys like me, journalists, right, in what we call the reality-based community, in which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from judicious study of discernible reality. The shootback from Rove is, that's not the way the world really works anymore, he continues. And Rove says, we're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating another new reality, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, journalists, all of you will be left to just study what we do, or in real time as mere stenographers. Do you see any of that at work potentially with Bannon and Trump wheeling out so many executive orders and so many things that they clearly know will cause great tumult and great reaction while they're already two steps ahead with the next agenda?
Absolutely. When they're pushing forward Orwellian propaganda, and look, this didn't start with Trump, but it definitely is being mastered by Trump and Bannon. When you're putting out statements that, and denying facts and say that they're simply alternative facts that bolster your worldview, that's psychotic Orwellian behavior. And that reality thing, look, the Trump administration is already putting the Bush administration to shame. Bush's oil ties are a joke. We have the CEO of ExxonMobil in the White House right now running foreign policy. Like, Steve Bannon has said in the past, fighting is good, anger is good, fear is good. He said Satan, Darth Vader, and Dick Cheney, that's power. He knows exactly what he's doing. He wants to foment civil war. He wants to crush leftists. This is it, baby. Steve Bannon at the helm, he wants this. He wants people fighting in the streets. He wants blood and guts. He said this. We can't let these people define the narrative for us. We can't let these people be victorious. We need to build a united front to the fascism that we're seeing unravel and take over this country within mere days. And already those journalists who were covering the protests, the inauguration, they're already being charged with 10 years of felony riot charges. There's an insane repression already on the press that is ramping up day by day, you guys.
And they're trying to bring that 10-year charges for rioting in North Dakota. But were you encouraged by the airport protests?
I was incredibly encouraged by the protests, and they weren't Soros operated. It was tons of cardboard signs. I've never seen more people coming out with things to do. These lawyers have full-time jobs. They were out there volunteering their time. They were sitting out there days on end, day and night, setting up little makeshift stands to help these refugees in the airport. And I saw thousands of strong rallies in Alabama, Ohio. People are on our side. We can't let these people set the narrative and tell us what the truth is. We know what the truth is. We love each other. We're brothers and sisters. We will be here for each other. We're not going to let this stand. We're not going to let Islamophobia and xenophobia dictate what we do in this country and how we pursue these policies and how we fight back. And that gave me more hope than anything has in a really long time.
So, Abby Martin, could you tell us a little bit more about your work lately? We know, of course, from Media Roots and the work you've done partnering with us at Project Censored and the great roundtable discussions and things we held last fall for our anniversary with you and Mark Crispin Miller, Manar Mahawish, David Talbot. But what are you working on now, of course, with the Empire Files on Telesur?
Well, of course, I've been a longtime board member of Project Censored because I think that everyone needs to donate to Project Censored. It's definitely the most important research organization in the country. But in the vein, keeping that fight alive and bringing it to other venues, I've been doing a show called The Empire Files for Telesur. It's basically cataloging and chronicling all of the underreported stories from the eyes of the marginalized and oppressed, because as we know, the victors write history. They write the narratives for us. And so we're retelling, we're recapturing what history really did and shows us and how we can use it to fight for a better future. And we cover everything from Native American rights to oil giants to really analyzing what the empire does to affect the people in this country and around the world. And I also have an ongoing podcast on Media Roots, Media Roots Radio with my brother. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. So everyone check it out, vampirefiles.tv and Empire Files on YouTube.
Abby Martin, thanks so much for all of your important work. It's vital, and I believe it's more important now than ever here as we are rolling through the 21st century into the Trump-Bannon era. So thanks again for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, you guys. Really great talking to you.
After this brief musical break, we'll be joined by whistleblowing journalist and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson to continue our conversation on the state of our so-called free press. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our theme today talking about the state of our so-called free press and media issues in an era of so-called fake news. We're joined right now by Christina Borgeson. She's an internationally acclaimed journalist. She's also a whistleblower in the field of journalism. She's an investigative reporter and media critic. Christina Borgeson has also put together several book projects. She was the editor of Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, and Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out. Christina Borgeson also wrote the introduction to Censored 2011, and is also a documentary filmmaker. Christina Borgeson, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
My pleasure, Mickey.
Christina, again, it's great to have you on the program, and let's dive right in to the state of our so-called free press early on here in the Trump administration and riffing on these themes and terms that have come out of the last year. We're now seeing the President of the United States wield weaponized language like fake news at institutions like CNN.
The whole fake news moniker is very interesting to me because it really is, to my mind, code for blowback. You know, blowback against the networks and the major press outlets that on a number of issues, key issues, for years and years, for decades, have been putting out basically incorrect news or news that they're fed by official source. You know, they've been putting out the official source reporting. So fake news is sort of code for official source reporting that's not true. And it's really come back to bite the press in a very, very big way now. And so now we have the muddiest information environment of all. I mean, it's just fake news over here, propaganda over there, PR over here. People don't know what to believe. But I think Trump, it's in a very weird and perverted way, I think that Trump did perform a service. I can still remember the first time all those presidential candidates were up there for their first debate. And at some point, he turned around and he said, you know, I've paid all of you. I've given money to all of you. And when I give money for something, I expect something back. And it's almost like he broke that spell. where even if the reporters would say that our politicians were bought off or whatever, here's a guy running for president who actually said it. And so he's got this sort of Tourette syndrome of reaching out and attacking. Of course, he lies. But my point to you is that he really has sort of lifted the veil on what a dirty, down low, full of falsehood information environment we live in, and how the press has contributed to that mightily. So in that sense, I think it's kind of weird and perverse, but he's provided a service, and people are looking to other places to get information.
It's interesting to me that you're saying blowback around the term fake news, in that certainly for a couple of generations now, public support and belief in corporate media has been in decline. But it's turned into sort of crisis entertainment news. And following CNN during the campaign, I mean, Trump was on every day. And so he got an enormous amount of attention, way and above all the other candidates, and certainly played on that. And
yeah.
Now his attack on the media, the New York Times will say he's a liar, but most of the other ones won't. NPR won't say that. They'll say, well, maybe he's just misinformed or something. You know, he doesn't really mean to lie. I think that he just says whatever he wants to say.
The press has always given a pass to the powerful. As a matter of fact, in my book, Feet to the Fire, I'm trying to remember who it was that I interviewed who said the New York Times had a policy of when a politician lied about a matter of policy, you did not say he lied. You say he misspoke. You could say he lied if he was talking about something private or personal. So it's not just Trump who was given a pass. And the reason why Trump got so much coverage was because he was more entertaining. The coverage has now been fully exposed. And I am giving Trump some credit for that. Because even though people knew that the press often misinformed through official source reporting, you'd still hear people say, well, you know, on CNN they said this. On one hand, they'd say, oh, you can't believe the press. And then they would say, oh, well, on CNN. So there were almost like two minds, and they were just going back and forth and back and forth. And now I think the attitude towards the press has really hardened.
And there have been many reactions to this, right? All of a sudden we've seen, well, we need to talk to Facebook. It's this whole outbreak of fake news is because of social media, and Google needs to step in. And you know, what we've been saying here at Project Censored, these other outlets are talking about censorship or proper not or blacklists. What's wrong with good old-fashioned critical media literacy education, critical thinking skills? Education is really a core feature here. And in fact, there are several states, including California now, that are working on bills to really build a critical media literacy education infrastructure, because the United States has long lacked one.
I think in the best of all possible worlds, that's fantastic. I think, first of all, our educational system does need to teach people critical thinking, because if people could think logically and critically, they just wouldn't buy a lot of the stuff that they see put out. They would see that there was no context in the reporting, no history, no context, and they would see when the information would go from it's black to it's white, and they would respond to that. So I think that's wonderful, but what you have right now is this highly reptilian war that is being waged for the minds of the American people. You've got all these government agencies that are doing it, the CIA, the FBI, the White House, the State Department, and then you've got the press, and you've got the press handmaiding government agencies as well as putting stuff out for their own agendas. So, I mean, it's so awful. And what's emerging now as the only press you can believe, and it's not even a press. Do you want to call WikiLeaks the press? It's now the world of real news, real investigation, is now the purview of whistleblowers and hackers.
And they've been ritually demonized, persecuted, and prosecuted.
Well, of course, because they're threatening the system.
Shooting the messenger is exactly what's happening, like with Gary Webb, who was very seriously targeted. And of course, you have in your books, Into the Buzzsaw, in particular, you have a roster of amazingly courageous journalists telling the stories of how they were silenced or lost jobs. You yourself have seen that personally.
It's happened to me on several occasions. This is something that has been going on for a very long time, but I think it's hitting critical mass now. I mean, I'm reminded of the Pentagon Papers and Ellsberg. Because Ellsberg had the cojones to put out those papers, he shortened the Vietnam War at a time when Nixon was looking to expand the war. And there is a video of Nixon talking to returning POWs. The first thing he talks to them about is how secrecy is very important. And he tells them what happened with Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers is a travesty. He just reviles him. And then he talks about how everybody's home when, of course, POWs were left behind. So he does two things. First, he lies about the POWs, and then he tells them how secrecy is important, even though the exposure of the Pentagon Papers is what got those POWs out earlier. And at the end of this spiel, the POWs stand up and they clap for 5 minutes. It's such a stunning moment because you realize that these people are completely in the dark. Nobody has made that connection for them. And that is what the press is supposed to do.
We're speaking with journalist and author and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the state of our so-called free press. Christina, we were talking about whistleblowers, the importance of whistleblowers. Before that, you had mentioned a little bit about the networks and certainly how much really kind of superficial and infotainment-like coverage was being given to Trump during the campaign. In fact, Les Moonves over at CBS, the chairman of the board, actually said that the Trump coverage led to increased profits. And he said, I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, he says, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS.
Right. And that's the thing. I think that responsible reporters, reporters who are not part of this system that is actually dying, I think that one of the things that we have to do is think about subjects to cover that help people disengage from these institutions that are really killing them financially and every other way. There are two main things, I think, that really affect people, and that is money and energy. People do not understand how banking works. They do not understand what alternatives there are, although the millennials, of course, are creating alternatives through Bitcoin, and they're creating alternatives to other things like hotels and stuff through Airbnb. They're creating people-to-people businesses that are starting to, like Uber, that are starting to sort of bring down these centralized institutions, and they're feeling threatened. But I really think that there's a whole area of reporting that needs to focus on these areas and also on renewable, sustainable energy. And I know it sounds kind of kumbaya or whatever, but imagine if you leached all the money out of those banks and started alternative ways of exchanging goods and services and so on and so forth, so that those banks could not control everybody the way they do. And the millennials have already started doing it. A lot of millennials do not have credit cards. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done, yes, in critical media viewing and media literacy. I think that's a real bottom line. But that's also a bottom line issue for our educational system. We have to teach our kids how to think, because if they can think logically, then they can see where they're being screwed. And a lot of these millennials are, as I say, are already starting to pull out of this. And I also think that to do that is to give people hope and to give people a direction that they can go in and act to make their lives better. I really think we have to focus on the more positive aspects of dealing with where we are now.
Christina, in all of my classes, I require students to subscribe to independent news sources and report back each week a news story that they thought was interesting. And part of our analysis, of course, is trying to put some of these stories together in a broader context. But we talk about what we really need to coverage now. I mean, certainly people in Black Lives would say we need to cover police killings holistically, not just somebody was shot in Minneapolis today and someone else, a mentally ill person, was shot in San Diego, but looking at it overall, this month the police killed 150 people, and that's 782 for the year so far. That kind of coverage, and then also the wealth concentration. And certainly Trump's cabinet is reflective of that with billionaires and generals, but the continuing concentration of wealth and the continuing decline of most working people in this country and worldwide, those are the kinds of stories that need to be repeated and continue to be talked about. We don't get that from corporate media. They're in the entertainment business, but we can get that from independent news sources and Truth Dig and Truth Out and Global Report and all of these, Common Dreams, all are very important sources for that continue to have these kinds of themes.
I agree, but people have to know what to do with their resources so they don't feed into this thing. The whole Black Lives Matter, police brutality, the wars that we're waging all over, people talk about terrorism, the coverage of terrorism never, ever goes back to the history of our intervention in these countries. So everybody's kind of crazed in a sense. People are angry, they're poor, they're hungry, and they're violent as a result. I mean, violence is attached, we know, to poverty. There also has to be a change in headspace in terms of how people consider themselves as individuals. We need a humanocracy. We need people who think about themselves and everybody else as much as themselves. These are sort of more fundamental philosophical things, I guess. It sounds like it to me, but I think the millennials are moving to make it more concrete through their people-to-people businesses, person-to-person exchanges for all kinds of goods and services. And my point to you is, I think that these are important things to focus on because the violence and the anger and the nastiness, it comes straight from the leadership on down. Maybe I sound like I'm coming out of left field to you guys. Again, the coverage of all of these things, the violence, the police violence against Black folks, what's going on in South Dakota, the wars in the Middle East, the endless wars, and the poverty that's going, and people think, oh yes, poor people voted for Trump because, they like Trump. And I don't think that's the case at all.
The neoliberal establishment has done very little for those groups other than negatively.
They've done nothing, and every administration that comes in continues to do nothing and continues to hand out the money. Every time there's a crash, banks have robbed people twice.
The road has been paved by neoliberalism from the Clintons through the Bushes through the Obamas, now back again. And now Trump is a more reactionary iteration of what we see going on. But a lot of this stuff has been coming down the pike for a long time. The corporate news media midwifed it. Sometimes they actively cheerled and promoted it. We can't be terribly surprised here, I think, but one of the solutions moving forward, I think, has to involve a restructuring of a people's media.
There is a media emerging. It's more than emerging. It's becoming quite a force. Assange is a perfect example of how much of a force it is. And these people like Assange, they don't just have the power, just like some of these hacktivists, they don't just have the power to expose things. They have the power to do something about it. They can create consequences for people. If you look at what happened when PayPal decided that they were going to continue allowing the KKK to collect money, but they shut down WikiLeaks, some hacktivists went in there and said, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to pay for that. So there's a game afoot or a movement afoot that is giving an exponential boost to this people's press that you're talking about.
And Christina Borgeson, this fifth estate, the whistleblowers, the leakers, the hacktivists, a sixth estate coming on board is crowd-contested media and a new startup called Tribeworthy that we've been consulting with, creating trusted news using critical media literacy, using fallacies, you know, using things that are out there on platforms that millennials are using, right? So this is a positive thing. And what I wanted to do just to wrap with you here now is, can you tell us a little bit about, because you're always working on so many things, books and movies and everything. And I know you have new things coming. Can you tell us a little bit about your next projects?
I have been for many, many years trying to come up with a major ongoing platform for whistleblowers, looking at their issues, looking at their lives, ongoing coverage of the issues, ongoing coverage of any problems or challenges that they face as a result of what they've done, et cetera, et cetera. And I just may be successful in that.
Well, Christina Borgeson, we'll certainly reach out to you and reconnect when that time is right, and we certainly want to hear more about it. So thank you
Great.
So much for all of your work, your whistleblowing, your intrepid journalism, and we look forward to talking to you in the near future.
Thanks so much, Mickey.
Okay, thanks, Christina Borgeson. Up next on the Project Censored Show, we're going to be talking about the State of Power 2017, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are joined also by senior correspondent for the program, Michael Levitin. In this segment of the show, we are going to be looking at a new study and new article done on the State of Power 2017, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex by Justin Schlossberg. And this is from the Transnational Institute. And Michael Levitin, please introduce our guest.
Justin Schlossberg is a media activist, researcher, and lecturer at University of London. He's chair of the Media Reform Coalition, and his latest book is Media Ownership and Agenda Control. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
You go over a lot of points in this essay, as well as in the infograph that you participated, that you contributed to, called Manufactured Consent. We want to talk about both of those today. But starting with the essay, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex. It's a mouthful, and most people would say they're familiar with the military industrial complex. You throw media and technology on the top of that. What do you want to say as your overarching theme with this?
Just that communications and the technology industries have always been central to the concept of a military-industrial complex, at least as Eisenhower first coined it and people like C. Wright Mills later talked about it. But I think the role played by the communications and technology sector today within that power elite is all the more significant.
Obviously, the era of Edward Snowden and the degree of information and the amount of sharing between technology companies and our military and our surveillance state, that clearly touched a chord globally, not least here in America, raising our awareness of the degree to which our media companies and these companies that kind of have their nice friendly appearance and role in our lives are actually quite interwoven in the government apparatus and the ability to surveil and potentially ultimately control what we do as citizens. What connections have you drawn focusing on Google and Facebook and the fact that 70% of news readers now come from those two sources alone? What are some of the connections you draw?
Well, I guess I'm looking at it from two perspectives, really. The first is, and you touched on this because it was largely revealed by the Snowden leaks, the fundamental interdependence between what many people are calling the platform monopolies and the state, and particularly the military and security state. And that really underlines not just what was in the Snowden leaks, but also what we've seen happen since with the kind of very public furor between Silicon Valley and the U.S. government. But really what that belies is the ongoing, very intimate cooperation and collaboration over what we could label blanket public surveillance programs. And you see that in the kind of local state level as well as the federal level. So that's kind of one aspect of it. And The other aspect is the fundamental interdependence between the platform monopolies or the intermediaries and the actual owners and producers of news content, the people that were once described as the news gatekeepers and the kind of really, you know, in radical liberal critique, the greatest threats to well-functioning democracies. But actually, again, what we see is a kind of surface rhetoric of conflict and even legal battles over things like ancillary copyright. Yet underneath that, there is very strong evidence of growing alliance and interdependence from everything in the way that algorithms work to promote and prioritize mostly mainstream dominant news brands to the actual deals that are being made. It would things like Facebook's instant articles. These are not sectors that are in protracted conflict, as many people believe. And it's certainly not the case that the new media gatekeepers are usurping power from traditional media owners and editors. They're working much more in concert.
Justin Schlossberg, Mickey Huff here. One of the top stories in our last book, Censored 2017, was on search engine algorithms, and it also looked at electronic voting machines and technology and how that could swing the 2016 election in the United States. But it did talk about search engine algorithms, and that's certainly something that you're writing about, a tyranny of algorithms. What do you see as a possible effect or outcome in terms of this kind of technology and the idea of manufacturing consent?
Well, I think part of the problem, one of the greatest obstacles to kind of understanding the complexities of this power is just getting through that apparent conflict and disconnect. The reality is we're living in a time where the buzzword is fake news, and that's attributed more often than not to the kind of niche, emergent, alternative news providers and voices that are supposedly being promoted by news algorithms like Google's, in kind of deference to the long tail of internet diversity, and that this is seen as now the great problem because the established CNNs and BBCs of the world no longer have this kind of authoritative voice and no longer able to provide a check on kind of fake or erroneous information. And that's, in my view anyway, almost exactly the opposite of what's happening in practice. The reality is that it is mostly the mainstream brands, mainstream news providers, both in the commercial and the public service sector, that are amplifying fake news more often than not and providing an echo chamber for it. So the problem really is not the way that Google is promoting sort of fringe alternative news voices. It's quite the opposite, actually. If you look at the way Google's news algorithm pattern has developed, it's very much in favor of promoting the likes of CNN and BBC. In fact, in Google's latest patent, they actually say explicitly that they don't consider hometown or local news sources to be as intrinsically as reliable as the likes of the CNN and BBC. That's the real problem, because we're almost kind of confronted by this doublespeak.
Justin, this is Peter Phillips. I'm looking at your 10 biggest media companies and the board interlocks, and this is something at Project Censored that we've observed and researched over the years for a long time. What we added to this element, though, is the idea that the big public relation firms, and we call them public relations and propaganda firms, WPP, Omnicom, and Interpublic Group, they're the largest, and they have hundreds of thousands of employees in thousands of offices all over the world. And they are creating literally fake news. Now, their history is advertising for products, but they now work for the Pentagon, the State Department, the military organizations, the World Economic Forum. They are spinning and planning the news, and corporate media runs this as content. So we know that about two-thirds or better of all stories are originating in one of these public relations firms.
Absolutely. And this has been researched and documented quite well in the UK and Europe and in the US over a number of years, that the growth and rise of the public relations industry and its centrality within centers of power of all description is very much undermining journalism and journalism's ability to hold power to account, to fulfill its supposedly unique contribution to democratic life. You just can't do that when most people who who are actively employed in the communications field are employed to do public relations rather than journalism. And part of the problem is that the distinction between the two is becoming increasingly blurred. And so there are many people now who are in communications roles, whether it's in an actual public relations firm, or there are increasingly law firms now that effectively do public relations work. They often don't see themselves as being the masters of spin.
And Justin, I think you could also add to that, as your infograph does on Transnational Institute, the think tanks that generate the political and the legislative kind of ideas, like you cited. You know, Wilbur Ross, who is tapped to be the Commerce Secretary under Trump, he was tapped by the Brookings Institute, by Brookings, as someone who should be in the Trump administration, and that's how he kind of arrives there, or the Heritage Foundation of four key staffers on the Trump transition team from there. That also plays into it. I want to say, though, that the idea that Google, at the same time that we're talking about them, that they spent $2.2 million on the 2016 elections, most of that to Republican candidates, that is certainly a new phase entering.
It's not necessarily a reflection of the fact that Google secretly favors the Republican Party. I mean, I think for better or for worse, I think most of big tech hedged their bets with Hillary, and they were caught a little bit unstuck. They're coming out of an administration that's been really a complete love-in with Silicon Valley. And the revolving door has been spinning at all levels of government, and you know, especially Google Federal, but also Facebook and others. And Obama's approach was simply to roll out the red carpet and do whatever that they say. There is obviously some concern that Trump wouldn't be as amenable, but I think the donation to the candidates, and also the fact that virtually all of Silicon Valley took up Trump's invitation to go and sit around the table at Trump Tower whilst he was president-elect, I think that, again, just indicates how deeply embedded the technology world is with the state, how deeply interdependent they are. And I think Trump's words were at the meeting, you know, anything you want, just give me a call. That's a continuation, not a break with successive administrations' policy.
Right. And Justin Schlossberg, I'm afraid we're out of time for this segment, but could you please give a website so people can go and read the study and learn more online?
I would recommend the website of the organization I represent, which is mediareform.org.uk, which has all manner of articles and resources very much related to that.
And tni.org also has these studies, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us. We definitely want to have you back on the program soon to get into more detail. This is certainly something that we very much have in common with you. So we're delighted to have made the connection, and special thanks to Michael Levitin.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Thank you for joining us today. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Also, come visit and see what we do online at www.projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces. Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse.